Okay, so why don't we get started with Joshua? Okay, we're moving along. We are almost done. I must say, we are really almost done. Another few weeks and we will be done with Joshua. Last week we did chapter 20 with the cities of refuge. Chapter 21, I'm not going to go through now because we referenced it when we discussed the cities of refuge. And we talked about the fact that also beforehand, we talked about the division of the cities between the different tribes. So chapter 21 is a continuation of that. And it's particularly, for the most part, about the Levites. And we referenced that last week when we talked about the cities of refuge, that all the cities of refuge were actually Levite cities. And then here we have in chapter 21, we have the list. Okay, anyway, so what we see in chapter 21 is that the various tribes are in a way taking some of their cities. In addition to the six cities of refuge, what we see now in chapter 21 is that the various tribes are basically portioning out to the Levites, each in their tribe, some cities and surrounding fields for the Levites. So that's really what we have. The most significant part of chapter 21 is the end. It's just such a nice kind of summary. And with the end of 21, we have the end of the conquest and settlement of the land, at least as of the book of Joshua. The Lord gave to Israel the whole country, which he had sworn to their fathers that he would assign to them. They took possession of it and settled in it. The Lord gave them rest on all sides, just as he had promised to their fathers on oath. Not one man of all their enemies withstood them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hands. Not one of the good things which the Lord had promised to the house of Israel was lacking. Everything was fulfilled. So it's this wonderful conclusion. And in a way, it's a wonderful conclusion to the book of Joshua. It could end right here. You know, they came in, they conquered the land. We have some details of some of the wars. At the end of the day, they conquered all the land. They parceled out all the land and everything is great. But of course, not everything is great. And we have in chapter 22, which is what we're going to do today, we have a very interesting story about the 2.5 tribes that end up settling on the eastern side of the Jordan. And 23 and 24 are two different speeches of Joshua in which he summarizes things and takes them further into the next generation. And each of those speeches will be different lessons. Okay, so let's focus now on chapter 22. The beginning of the chapter, verses 1 through 8, talks about taking the land on the eastern part of the Jordan and giving it to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, half of Manasseh. And this is something that really has its origins in the book of Numbers, where after the nation of Israel conquered that part of the land already under Moses, the Bashan, the Amorites in that area, at that point, we have two tribes, Reuben and Gad, coming and approaching Moses and saying, we'd like to stay here. They have a lot of cattle and they see that the land there on the eastern part of the Jordan is a very fertile land. It's excellent grazing land. There's a lot of it and they want to stay there. And that becomes an issue. So I'm going to go back. I want to take a look at what happens there. But just to point out what we see here, in verses 1 through 6, Joshua is speaking only to Reuben and Gad. And in verse 7 until 7 and 8, he addresses himself separately to the half of tribe of Manasseh. And what we will see is that actually has its antecedent in the original story. Okay. So let's go back to the original story, which is in the book of Numbers, chapter 32. And that story begins, the Reubenites and the Gadites owned cattle in very great numbers. That's how it starts. They're after this war, and therefore they come up to Moses and ask him for the land. Now, Moses has problems with this, okay? There's a few issues he raises with them. He doesn't like it at all, and he raises his objections to them, and we can summarize them as follows. The first thing he says to them, verse 6. The first thing he says is, are your brothers to go to war while you stay here? So his first claim, it's not fair. the entire nation fought together for this land on the eastern part. If you're going to take that land and stay here, then you're leaving the rest to fight on their own for the rest of their land. It's not fair. The second thing is he's saying, why will you turn the minds of the Israelites from crossing into the land that the Lord has given them? Here, Moses is concerned that by the very fact that these two tribes want to stay on the west, on the east of the Jordan, is going to create, you know, and he brings up to them what happened with the spies, that there's this reticence that we already met 40 years earlier when the spies came back and said, oh, you don't want to go in. And then this may pull them back into that situation of, oh, well, if these two tribes aren't going to go in, why do we have to go in? Why don't we just all stay here? And this, of course, is a huge fear that he has. And then it's a fear not only of what will happen, but of the fact that this will, he talks about how God was so angry at the spies at this point for all of this. And he then says, well, then God will be angry with you as well if you repeat this kind of issue. And then he goes to verse 14, and he says, now you, a breed of sinful men. Well, that's an interesting, that's one way of translating this word. Another way of saying you now have come up instead of your, replacing your fathers, have added. In other words, the word in Hebrew is tarbut. And the question is tarbut similar to the way we understand tarbut today? Tarbut today would mean culture, or a way of life, or the way people are in a given group or a given civilization. And so is it meaning you're a breed of sinful men, you're a culture of sinful men? Or is it coming from the word rov or harbe, which means many? In which case, what they're saying is you're going to be adding more sinful people to what you're doing now, okay? To add still further to the Lord's wrath against Israel, if you turn away from him and he abandons them once more in the wilderness, you will bring calamity upon all this people. And that's another thing that I would like to point out here. Moses is concerned not just that they will cause anger of God, but that God's anger will then not just be directed at them, these two tribes, but that will cause anger to be directed against the entire nation. And here it's not clear, and I would say we could really go either way on them. It's not really clear if this idea of having anger and the whole nation is connected to his initial concern that their action will sway the rest of the nation. So is it that when God unleashes his anger, he's indiscriminate, and therefore when one group of people in the nation causes anger, God will just indiscriminately be angry at all of them? Or is it more, once these people do this, they will sway the others to sin as well, and that will ultimately bring God's anger against everybody, because everybody will have deserved that anger. Now, of course, these two tribes come forward and they immediately say, don't worry, we're going to settle our kids and our wives, and then we're going to go fight. Okay, so he gets rid of that first question. He says, it's not fair to get out of fighting. They're going to fight, not to worry. Okay, and then he talks about let's look at chapter 20, at verse 23. After Moses says to them, you know, this is their main thing. We're going to fight. And then Moses goes back to them and he adds another thing. They said, we're going to fight. Don't worry. We're going to fight. And they actually add something, these two tribes. They said, we're not only going to join the fighting, we're going to be the forward troops. We're going to be there at the beginning, okay? And so then Moses picks up on that in verse 20, and he says to them, if you do this, if you go as forward troops at the instance of the Lord, and every one of you forward troops among you crosses the Jordan at the instance of the Lord till he has dispossessed his enemies before him, and the land is subdued, etc. He says, and follow, and then you return. You shall be clear before the Lord and before Israel, and this land shall be your holding under the Lord. But if you do not do so, you will have sinned against the Lord, and know that your sin will overtake you. Okay? So here, it's very interesting. When Moses responds to them, he kind of changed what he said before. If before he's saying, I'm afraid if you stay on this side of the river, God's going to punish everybody. At the end, he says to them, but if you don't go forward with us and fight with us, okay, then God will punish you. Which I think is very interesting. And I think basically one of the concerns he has is that this isn't a question of lack of unity. And I think this is an underlying fear. What is this fear of those will fight without you? That means you have a nation that doesn't stand in solidarity with one another. And this is something that's very, very important, because once they enter the land, it's very possible that they'll have an enemy striking one section of the land. Only the northern area will be attacked. Well, the expectation should be that people from the entire people of Israel will come and fight together to help their brother at the northern edge of the city, of the country. And so what I think Moses hears right away, even though he's not for sure that they're going to actually do it, but what he hears right away is a sense of solidarity. We are not going to let our brothers sit by themselves. And so he knows already that even if something goes wrong, it didn't go wrong because the principle of solidarity wasn't there. It goes wrong because they failed to do what they were supposed to do. It came from weakness or something else, but that they don't see themselves as a separate group. And this, of course, is essential to understanding what happens in our chapter in Joshua. Now, of course, one of the questions that comes up is, why Menashe? All of a sudden, this whole time in Numbers, the conversation has been only between the two tribes, Reuben and Gad, and Moses. Only at the very end of the story, when they come to agreement, at that point, Moses, all of a sudden, in verse 33, like at the end of the chapter, then all of a sudden it says, and Moses assigned to them, to the Gadites, the Reubenites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, and it tells about these different portions on the eastern side of the river. So how did they come into the picture? They never asked for this. They weren't part of the original discussion. Why do we suddenly have Manasseh? So in the continuation of that story, we see that Moses, at the same time that he adds Menashe, he adds for them an extra requirement. And here I'm going to share a screen. Okay, so you see the map here? Okay. Okay. Oh, no. Okay, good. Yeah. I saw you guys and then I stopped seeing you. Right. Here we go. Okay, good. All right, so if you can see on this map, this is the Jordan River. This is the area on the eastern side of the river. Here's Reuben, here's Gad, and here's the half of Manasseh. But you can see on this map, and the map I showed you last week is a little bit different because it's not clear how far north Menashe went. I actually like this map for what we're doing today because it really shows you the connection between the western side of Menashe, or Manasseh as it's in English, and the eastern side, okay? So if you look at this map, I think it becomes very clear what Manasseh's role is. Manasseh, especially as showing it here, has this one tribe that spans from the Mediterranean across the Jordan River way east into what is Jordan today. In a way, Manasseh becomes the bridge. If there was a concern that these two tribes, Gad and Reuben, would end up on the eastern side of the river and not be so connected, which is, of course, the underlying concern that Moses expresses when he says, oh, but it's not fair that other people will fight instead of you. He's talking not just about fighting, he's talking about the extent of a feeling of unity. Is there a danger that once these people are on the other side, they will be removed, they will be isolated, will no longer feel connected to the rest of the nation? When he adds Manasseh here, okay, he suddenly has, like, almost as if one territory. I see it as a bridge. The bridge of the Jordan River ends up being just a line where Manasseh crosses the whole thing. And that way they act as a sort of bridge of enabling the nation to feel connected to one another. So these guys feel very connected to Manasseh, but Manasseh, it feels very connected to the people on the other side as well, because they're all one family. Okay, so we have two basic reasons here about why he puts in Manasseh. One, because this area had not yet been conquered and it needed to be conquered, and Manasseh may have been the one who volunteered, says, yeah, we'll take care of it. At which point Moses says, okay, you'll take that land. But other than that, I think it was it was a half a tribe of Manasseh, not the whole tribe. It's the half a tribe that's so important because it has a connection to the other half of the tribe. And that's something you can clearly see here. Okay, so now let's go back to our story in Joshua 22. So they all go and everything is great, it seems, okay? And then all of a sudden we see in verse 10, this is in our chapter, now chapter 22, verse 10, when they came to the region of the Jordan in the land of Canaan, it says the region of the Jordan, it's the passageways crossing the Jordan, and that can be anywhere between Jericho and a bit north of Jericho. It's that area where the Jordan River is lowest, and where it would be also the same place where the children of Israel would have crossed the Jordan to begin with. So as they go through the passageways and cross the Jordan, okay, the Reubenites and Gadites and the half tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a great conspicuous altar. Okay, whoa, now this becomes a problem. And the question is, what is it that they had in mind? Well, you'll see now immediately the rest of the nation is very angry. Okay, they immediately jump to a conclusion. They are convinced this is it. This is an act of separation. What do they say? A report reached the Israelites, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half tribe of Manasseh and built an altar opposite the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan across from the Israelites. When the Israelites heard this, the whole community of the Israelites assembled at Shiloh to make war on them. Okay? They immediately jumped to conclusions that this is an act of rebellion, or an act of rebellion against God, an act of rebellion against the unity of the country, some kind of rebellion, and therefore they are going to immediately go to war. Very, very interesting, because later on in the book of Judges, at the end of the book of Judges, we are going to have a completely different situation, the situation with the concubine from Gibeah. But again, we have a civil war where they gather in Shiloh, okay? And here again, they gather in Shiloh. So, well, Shiloh is where the tabernacle was. It's clearly a place where they can meet the high priest, ask God what to do. And in Judges, it has a much different outcome in here. But one of the things that's very interesting is that, like in the story in Judges, also here, the leader that plays the role is Phinehas, okay? Now, let's remember something about Phinehas. Phinehas is the guy who, in the desert, in the book of Numbers, there was this whole terrible incident of what it's called Baal Peor, okay? Baal Peor is this terrible sin where the Midianites came and the Moabites came, and they seduced some of the daughters of Israel to go and take part in this worship of Peor, Baal Peor, which was an idol. And the worship is not only betraying God and pagan worship, but it was also a worship that was very sexually involved, okay? It was a very sexual kind of whatever that they were doing as part of the worship. And Moses stands there, he's completely frozen. He doesn't know how to behave, he doesn't know how to react. And it's the story is in the book of Numbers chapter 25. Okay, if you wanna look at that another time, I'm not gonna go through the story now, but that's where it is. And at that point, Moses is frozen. Phinehas, who's there, Phinehas is his nephew, great nephew, actually. He is Aaron's grandson, and he pulls out his sword and he goes up to the two main culprits and he kills them in front of everybody. And, you know, this ensues this, let's get rid of all these people. And then there's a plague. God punishes these people, and it's a mass destruction. It's very interesting that it is Phinehas who's the one who understands this is a time that needs action, and he goes and acts at a point where Moses doesn't really know what to do. God blesses Phinehas as a result of that, and so he gives certain confirmation for the way Phinehas act, even though it was quite a immediate, you could say on the one hand it was extreme, it was zealous, it was violent, okay? And yet in that kind of situation, God says, no, you acted right. But what he does is he gives to Phinehas, yes, I see, Judah, you wrote it, he gives to Phinehas a covenant of peace, okay? And many people have questioned, what is this covenant of peace? Here's the guy who just pulls out his sword and goes, stabs these two people in the middle of everybody. Why is he being, on the one hand, God is approving of this action, on the other hand, he's giving him a covenant of peace. And one of the explanations that I particularly like about this whole thing is that what we're seeing as Phinehas is a tendency to act before you think, or perhaps to act too quickly, all right? Where in some cases, and with violence, okay? Where in some cases it works. In some cases, it is exactly what is needed at that time. And that was the situation that Phinehas dealt with. But I think God is saying to that, you know what? Sometimes you're gonna have to really be careful. And I don't wanna turn you, Phinehas, into someone who's just walking around with his sword all the time and just killing everybody who's doing something wrong, okay? So he gives them a covenant of peace. It's kind of a divine gift that helps him kind of restrain himself and only use this war, violence, et cetera, when absolutely needed. And I think here in our story, we're seeing the covenant of peace at work, because whereas all the nation gathers and they're ready to make war, they're the Phinehas of the story. Here we have Phinehas, and he's the one who's gonna end up leading a peace delegation to these 2.5 nations to find out, tribes, to find out exactly what they have in mind. And so I see, and while it doesn't exactly say that Phinehas is the one that says, okay, guys, let's not go to war, I think it's assumed, because what it says is they come, in verse 12, it says they're coming to go to war. And the next verse is, but first the Israelites sent the priest Phinehas, son of Eleazar, to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half tribe of Manasseh in the land of Gilead. Okay, so I'm assuming they come to the tabernacle in Shiloh. Phinehas is the high priest. And so he's there and he comes and they come and they say, oh, he says, so, okay, guys, wait. Before you go to war, let's give peace a chance. Okay, so he goes out and he goes ahead of this delegation and he goes to these people and he goes to them and he tells them of his concerns. Now, let's remember the concerns that Moses originally had, because I think they have certain things in common. Okay, so first of all, we see that he's concerned. If you look at verse 16, he says, what is this treachery that you have committed this day against the God of Israel, turning away from the Lord, building yourselves an altar and rebelling this day against the Lord? So the first thing he says is you're rebelling. You're rebelling against God, okay? What is the next thing he says in verse 18, he says, and now you would turn away from the Lord. If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow, he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. Again, echoing what Moses had said, if you anger God, it's not only going to cause anger against you, it goes anger against the entire nation. Okay. And then you have in verse 19, it says, if it is because the land of your holding is unclean, cross over into the land of the Lord's holding, where the tabernacle of the Lord abides, and acquire holdings among us. But do not rebel against the Lord, and do not rebel against us by building yourselves an altar other than the altar of the Lord your God. So again, he's looking at this theme of rebellion against God, but here it is saying to them, going into this idea of the problem of unity. He's saying, are you concerned that you're living in a separate land? That the holiness of the tabernacle that is helping our land here west of the Jordan become holy, are you concerned that where you are is less holy? And therefore, it's not just a question of holiness, it's a question of separation. Are you now separating yourself in a different type of land from us and therefore feel a need to have your own temple of holiness or whatever? And so they say to them, the answer to that fear is not to build a separate temple. The answer to this, come back and live among us. So you see, it's not just a question of holy temples. It's a question of, are you dividing yourself from us? And if you feel divided, your answer is not to replicate us, but to come back amongst us. To live with us, okay? So we see very similar this idea of rebelling against God, that God will be angry, and at the same time, this idea of unity that underplays the things that Moses had talked to them about to begin with. Now, there are two examples given here. One is the example of Achan that we read about at the beginning of Joshua, where one man ended up taking from the spoils of Jericho, of Jericho, and causing punishment not only against him, but against the entire nation. So that's an example that Phinehas is using now to say, well, you know, just like God then was angry at everybody, now too, even if it's just you guys doing something a problem, like, he could be angry at everybody. But he makes another example. He goes back to that same Baal Peor incident that the last time Phinehas starred. And he talks there, though, about the fact that this could possibly end up being a temple for pagan worship. Okay? And of course, we know how terrible that could be. Now, we have no indication, by the way, from before that when they set up this whatever it is, let's say altar, that there's no indication that this is for pagan worship from the very beginning. It's to worship God. But I think what Phinehas here is revealing is that fear. And we see that, by the way, later on in history, when we look at the book of Kings, okay, what sometimes began as an altar to God turns into an altar to pagan worship. If we think about Jeroboam, for example, who starts the problem by putting up these two different altars, one in Bethel and one in Dan in the north, then he puts up a golden calf. Okay, so, okay, he starts out building these places because he's going to now seal the border and not let the nation of Israel go down to Jerusalem. But he doesn't just build alternative altars to worship God. The next thing you know, they're worshiping the golden calf. So there is this slippery slope here where you go from multiple places of worship to multiple gods. And this, of course, is what Phinehas is very concerned. But of course, there is a happy ending, because these two and a half tribes assure them that they had absolutely no interest whatsoever in building an altar. It may look like an altar, but they have absolutely no intention of bringing sacrifices or turning this into a temple. And what do they say? They say, look in verse 28, the way they say it is just so beautiful. Let's go before this. He says, look in verse 24. We did this thing only out of our concern that in time to come, your children might say to our children, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between you and us, O Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in the Lord. Thus your children might prevent our children from worshiping the Lord. So instead of trying to divide themselves from the nation, what they're doing is trying to unite themselves with the nation, not just for themselves, but for the generations to come. They see this altar as a testimony, as a monument of testimony that is linking them with Shiloh, linking them with the rest of the nation of Israel, as opposed to separating them. And they're looking into the future and they're saying, we have this little kind of boundary here, but we want to make sure it doesn't become a boundary between the nations. We want to make sure that your children and our children still see themselves as one nation. So we decided to provide a witness for ourselves by building an altar, not for burnt offerings or other sacrifices, but as a witness between you and us, and between the generations to come, that we may perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt, our sacrifices and our offers of well-being, and that your children should not say to our children in time to come, you have no share of the Lord. So in the Lord. So this is, in other words, they have every intention of coming to Shiloh. Shiloh remains the central place, but this is a sort of monument that enables them to feel connected. So it sounds like it's all great, and it's a happy ending, and there's no fights, and there's no war, and everybody is good. But the question is, what happens later? And I just want to conclude. In further books of the Bible, there's very little said about the tribes in the two and a half tribes there. Okay, we don't know that much about them. We know more about Manasseh, things going on, wars that happen in the north with Ahab, for example, is happening in that area of Manasseh, crossing both sides. But there are two places that indicate that the tensions remain and sometimes really get out of hand. One place is in the book of Judges, chapter 12. And here, this is kind of an addendum to the story of Yiftach, Jephthah, the judge. And, you know, he goes through this war and all that. And it's after all that, after his daughter and the whole thing. Then there's another little story. And the story is where the people from the tribe of Ephraim go to Jephthah and say, why didn't you call us? Now, Yiftach is from the eastern side of the Jordan. He's from Manasseh. He's from the land of Gilead. And so he's dealing with things on the eastern side of the Jordan. And he takes care of the problem on the eastern side of the Jordan. And throughout the story, we don't have any indication that it's an east versus west. It is a problem for the nation of Israel. The problem's coming from the east. Jephthah, who lives in the east, he is taking care of it. And then after it's all over, you have the tribe of Ephraim, who is very related to Manasseh, okay? They're both the sons of Joseph. They're very, very related. He comes up to me and says, how dare you not call us? And this creates a civil war where the people from Manasseh and the east are killing the people from Ephraim in the west and vice versa. Okay, this is a civil war. And of course, they end it and, you know, it's fine, but it's terrible. Okay, and it's something because you read the story of Jephthah and you get all excited about what happens to the daughter. Okay, very often you forget what happens at the end of the story. And this is the end of the story. So you see there is civil war between these two tribes on both sides of the river. Okay, and the next thing, of course, is the tragedy of the exile. When we learn in the Second Kings, when we learn the stories of the exiles, first of the Northern Kingdom, then the Southern Kingdom, there's almost no mention of what's going on with Reuben, Gad, and the half a tribe of Manasseh. There's no mention of it in the Book of Kings. And it's only in the Book of Chronicles, in First Chronicles, chapter 5, verse 26, that we learned that it is Tiglath-Pileser, who is the one who exiles those people on the east, those two and a half tribes. And if we look carefully, we'll see that Tiglath-Pileser was the king before Shalmaneser. Shalmaneser was the guy who exiled the northern kingdom, okay? The king before him exiled the two and a half tribes. And I think it's very interesting because you would think that there would be some echo of this in the Book of Kings. Already, part of the nation has been exiled. Part of the nation has been taken. We have great sensitivity to the fact that the northern kingdom is exiled, and we know how it affects them, and we know how it affects Judah, who's sitting in the south and looking and saying, oh my goodness, and where are we next? And you know that. But when years earlier, under an earlier king, the two and a half tribes are already exiled, silence, nothing. So I think that also tells us that by the time we get to the end of the Northern Kingdom, which of course includes the two and a half tribes, those two and a half tribes, they're just not so connected. They're not so connected to the rest of the Northern Kingdom. They're not so connected to Judah. And indeed, we don't hear anything about them in the Book of Kings at the end. So that's just a few insights. I think, it's a problem when you have a division of this kind, and does physical division bring a division, a national solidarity? This, of course, is the challenge, and a challenge that Moses understood from the beginning, a challenge Joshua understood. And we see that it was something that had to be dealt with throughout.
Absolutely fascinating.
Can I say something?
Thank you, Pauline. Yes, of course.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's very interesting because when there was an exile, a whole part of the tribes went here or went there. And I was always wondering, how come it that any place that there are Jews, you have a Levi? Because they did not have a Nachala.
Right.
Because they were all over. So no matter who was exiled, Leviim were among them.
They had a Levi, right. And that's, you know what, first of all, we see that in 21, which we didn't read through today, but I just kind of skimmed it, how each of the tribes gave to the Levite city. So the Levites were everywhere. They had cities in every one of the tribes.
That's what I mean.
But also there's a very interesting story in 2 Kings chapter 17, right in the middle of this thing of the exile of the Northern Kingdom, where you have this, the issue of what becomes the history of the Samaritans. the people that have come from the East, and they're Kuti, they're from Kut and these other places, and they need to know how to worship, and it's the Assyrian general who brings them a Levite. So, you know, there were these Levites all over the place, just like you said. He brings them a Levite, so he brings them from Judah. There was a Levite sitting there, you know, and he says, here, come, teach him how to pray.
It's so interesting that because they did not have a portion, then they are all over, you know, it's very interesting. And then another thing that is that nobody pays attention, when you show the map and they and Dan near where today is Jaffa, you know, there is also Dan in the north. When we say from Dan to Eilat, or you even mentioned before, and the north Dan. So Dan, either it's only a city, or it's also a portion.
No. Well, we talked about this. I think I mentioned this in one of the classes. Maybe I think I did. That, and that you see, by the way, in the book of Judges, in a few towards the end there, what actually happened. Dan began having its territory in similar to where Tel Aviv is today. Like Tel Aviv, when we talk about the greater Tel Aviv area, we call it the Block of Dan. That was where they initially had their territory going up until Beit Shemesh, bordering on Judah. And when you have Samson, who we have in the book of Judges, he's from the tribe of Dan, and that's where he's from. He's in the area of Beit Shemesh. He's actually west of Beit Shemesh, Eshtaol.
No, but I'm talking about Dan in the north.
So then what happens is, and we see that at the end of the book of Judges, at some point, okay, there's a delegation of people that go from the south, from Dan, and they say, we don't have enough territory. We're squeezed out by the Philistines in the west and Judah in the south, and we just need a better place. And they go up and they capture Laish, and that becomes the city of Dan. And so they then move the tribe up north. And it's at that point, at the end of the book of Judges, that they end up, the Dan is up in the north as opposed to in the Tel Aviv area. So I think I mentioned that once before, but it's good to review that.
I thought it was because they were having too difficult a time near Tel Aviv.
They moved up. Exactly, because they were being squeezed out by the Philistines on one side. Yeah. And then, and they didn't have enough territory, because then they come into Judah, and Judah had their own territory. So that's why they go up.
Sandra, there's something I wanted to say before you go. Do you see my little hand? I raised my hand.
Oh, I do now, yes.
Okay, that's so, you know, I wanted to say something. In your last letter, the newsletter that you mailed out, you wrote something that was so good. I wanted to thank you for it. At the very end, you said, if you repeat a lie often enough, it will become the truth. Yeah, you remember saying that about the land? I clipped it out and laminated it.
Oh, wow.
I've already used this. The very last line, the land of Israel belongs to the people of Israel, always has and always will. That's a new mantra. And I love these little short things that people can remember, because sometimes we say too much and their eyes glaze over and you've lost them already. So these kinds of things are very helpful. And I just wanted to thank you for it.
Well, thank you, April. I appreciate that. Wow. Thank you. Okay. Anyway, anybody else have anything they want to say?
Sandra?
Okay. Yes, Richard.
A question. Are you aware of any sort of archaeological evidence for that altar that you're talking about, or monument, on the eastern side of the river?
It's a good question, but I don't know. I've never heard of that, but I'm not an expert. I don't know that they have found anything like that.
I was just thinking of it because the archaeological evidence for Joshua's altar is becoming pretty clear, and that's been established, and that's where it is. Right. So I was wondering if there was anything like that for this one, but maybe not.
No. Well, first of all, the area of the Jordan Valley is a center for earthquakes. And there have been
severe
earthquakes, because it's in the Syrian African Rift.
Yeah.
And there's been many earthquakes over the centuries. And so I would assume that, you know, if it was,
it would have been destroyed there. Yeah.
Trouble.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, yes, and Judy is saying tomorrow we have a chat with our Australian audiences, but for those in Europe, you can join that as well. That is tomorrow, And it's, I think, 11 o'clock Israel time. So it's 9 o'clock UK time and 10 o'clock Sweden, I believe. So anyway, see you all.
Can I ask you something? Can I ask something?
Pardon? Sandra?
Thank you.
Can I ask you, we just got a letter that you told about the police station that you were in and you were talking. And is there copyright on that? I mean, can I share that letter? Because it just reduced me to tears.
Sure, go ahead. Everything that I put out, you can share with anyone. Just credit it. Just say you got this from CFOIC, you know. Okay. But absolutely anything I share out, just spread it around. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story.
Yes. Okay, great.